mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Never mind the "what doesn't kill you makes you stronger" sentiments of motivational plaques and pop songs. Rejection bites. Anybody who's been cast aside by an early love or passed over by an employer may find some comfort in learning that the Diary of Anne Frank was rejected by 16 publishing houses, including an editor at Knopf who panned it as a dreary record of typical family bickering, petty annoyances, and adolescent emotions. Also dismissed were George Orwell's Animal Farm and manuscripts by Jack Kerouac, Sylvia Plath, and in an infamously mocking rejection letter, Gertrude Stein. Jeff Schatz is executive editor at Grey Wolf Press, where he writes his fair share of rejection letters, and he's with us to talk about an essay he wrote on the art of rejection, an art he does not recommend to others. Jeff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, here's the cold math that you tallied. Grey Wolf accepts under one-third of 1% of submissions. You must have written a lot of rejection letters.
As I say in the piece, I have done some terrible math, and some of it is exactly what you've quoted. Another statistic is I believe I've probably written at least 2,000 rejection letters in 15 years of publishing.
Oh, that's hard to hear.
It's hard to write.
Well, when you became an editor, what kind of advice did you receive about writing rejection letters?
Not very much. And I think that's part of the reason I wanted to write the piece is there needs to be a culture, and this goes for publishing houses or grant makers or contests, where there is some way that we impart this knowledge to those who are learning the art, in this case, the art of rejection or the art of publishing. We publish about 30 to 35 books a year. So it's those odds are stacked against writers, and I know that it's very hard for writers to hear those numbers. I wanted to, in my piece to turn the tables and sort of show that those numbers are also stacked against the person who has to do the rejecting part of it.
That kind of volume requires a form letter.
It requires a form letter. It requires many editors keep a sort of template letter that they can fill out relatively quickly, in part because of the volume, but in part because psychologically and spiritually, it's hard to spend a lot of time turning someone down. It's excruciating.
It must be very difficult. But you also write in your essay about being nice, especially when compared to some of the more scathing rejection letters on record. We mentioned Gertrude Stein's. Apparently, Alfred Knopf wrote to historian John Hope Franklin, "We feel that you've completely missed your chance to write a colorful and dramatic book." Snap! I mean, that's got to hurt. How do you soften the blow?
I think by being empathetic, by putting yourself in the position of the writer, and realizing that you're in a position where what you say matters to that person, and sometimes a great deal. So I think even simple things, using the author's name, that sounds like a simple thing, but most of those form letters, and understandably with that volume, start, "Dear author."
I guess they know what the message is going to be after that.
Yeah, you don't even have to read after a salutation like that, right? I mean, it's an already understood in the framework of a rejection letter that "dear author" nothing good can follow that. Use the author's name and use your own name when you sign off. The more human this back and forth, this conversation, and I think it is a conversation, the more human that can be, I think the more empathetic the whole possibility of the writer-editor relationship can be from the start. I think so many writers have a sense of the editor being a sort of adversary, a sort of gatekeeper, an obstacle, in the way of their genius. And sometimes that's true. I mean, those scathing rejection letters you mentioned, I mean, they can be incredibly crushing. especially to someone who has spent, in many cases, years or decades producing, you know, a novel or a play or a book of poetry or a translation, you know, any of those works that take a lifetime of learning to really produce, and then to have it so cursorily dismissed, that's crushing.
Well, do you have that sense that you are determining somebody's fate when you're writing this back? Which can cut both ways, let's face it, Jeff. You know, a lot of pieces of literature that are submitted and get rejected for very good reasons. And maybe people should not be trying to make their career out of writing.
Well, that's true, but that's not for me to say. I mean, only the author can make that decision, whether to keep writing or to stop writing. I often tell writers that the truth is you'll probably be able to wallpaper your entire bathroom with rejection letters. And that's part of the deal. And really at any level, I've certainly heard magazine editors mention to me they've turned down Nobel Prize winners before.
Has that ever happened to you? We read about, you know, these rejection letters of famous authors. Did you ever let someone slide and think, oh, God, I really regret that?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, every editor, there are those books that come to you, you know, in a submission form, or maybe they come from the agent or come directly from the author, where that work is in a really early form. And you can't always make the call. And literary history will always prove you wrong. You know, we don't know yet. It's the kind of amazing thing about literary history and the way that time and special collections and archives work in this industry is all of those things will prove us all wrong. The editor wants to be known for, of course, selecting, you know, this writer and this writer and this Pulitzer Prize winner and this National Book Award winner. And sometimes that happens. History often shows, I mean, as you did with, you know, talking about The Historian and talking about Anne Frank and Nabokov and others who were turned down many, many times. I mean, we can now go back into those archives and sort of laugh. You know, we laugh a little bit when we see that horrible letter from Arthur Fifield to Gertrude Stein. That is one of the most sort of, you know, mocking her style back to her, which I think is one of the most biting rejection letters I've ever read. But in the end, I mean, the joke of history is on him. That said, I'm glad to say that at least so far, I have not turned down any Nobel Prize winners.
Okay, we're going to ask if you'd be willing to name names.
I, you know, a good editor should not name names, but part of it is, I mean, you know, you turn something down. You know, I mentioned, you know, something comes to you in maybe an early form. Let's say 2 years later, you see that book being picked up by another press. And it's, you know, and it's totally transformed and it's different and it's better. And maybe you would have made a different decision if the manuscript would have come to you like that. But it means that editor at that other publishing house saw something that you didn't see. And this is why, rather than competing with each other, I think we're all in the same collective enterprise of bringing forward the art of literature. And that's really important to have those colleague presses, not as adversaries or competitors, though, I mean, of course, that's there in the background.
Well, how about you? I mean, you are a person who's in the business of publishing, but also of rejecting people. How do you typically respond to rejection? I mean, are you analyzing the form of the letter and noting that your name would be named? Or were you just thinking about the message? Oh, they don't like me. They don't want me.
I think the message hits first. I mean, how can it not? I want to try to even give a sentence that says why we made this decision. You know, and it can be, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to put your finger on something to tell someone why you turned them down. But I hope that says to the writer, maybe not on that first reading, but on that second reading, that might be helpful to them or helps them at least understand from Grey Wolf Press, just one publisher of many, why we made the decision we did. I hope that's helpful. And I hope that's more helpful than just saying, no, your work is not wanted at this time.
Jeff Schatz, executive editor at Grey Wolf Press. Thank you so much for, staying with us.
Thank you. I hope your listeners don't mind hearing about rejection.
Well, you know, everybody has to live with it. It's good to hear it on the other side. You can read Jeff's essay on the art of rejection, including some of the revenge responses that we could not share on radio that are really worth looking at. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Jeff Schatz included several notable rejection letters in his essay to remind all of us that the old gatekeepers did not always get it right. We decided to turn a few notable examples into dramatic readings. During our conversation, Jeff mentioned one of the most famously cutting rejection letters ever penned. Gertrude Stein is now well known for her use of repetition as a rhetorical device. But when she submitted the manuscript for Three Lives to a London publisher, she was a relative unknown and got this mocking response.
A letter to Miss Gertrude Stein from Arthur C. Fifield, publisher. April 19th, 1912. Dear Madam, I am only one, only one, only one. Not two, not three, only one. Only one life to live. Only 60 minutes in 1 hour. Only one pair of eyes, only one brain, only one being. Being only one, having only one pair of eyes, having only one time, having only one life, I cannot read your manuscript 3 or 4 times. Not even one time. Only one look is enough. Hardly one copy would sell here. Hardly one, hardly one. Many thanks. I am returning the manuscript by registered post. Only one manuscript by one post. Sincerely, Arthur C. Fifield, publisher.
Getting a personalized rejection letter is pretty rare. More often, publishers, record companies, and movie houses rely on carefully worded form letters, like this one from Sub Pop, the record label that signed Nirvana. The letterhead reads, "From Sub Pop, celebrating several years of record making.
Dear Loser, thank you for sending your demo materials to Sub Pop for consideration. Presently, your demo package is one of a massive quantity of commendable material we receive every day at Sub Pop World Headquarters, and, due to time and volume restrictions, is on its way through the great lower intestine that is the talent acquisition process. We appreciate your interest in Sub Pop and wish you the best in your pursuit. Kind regards." Footnote: this is a form letter. This letter is what is known as a rejection letter.
Gold teeth and a curse for this town. They're all in my mouth. Only I don't know how.
What we're listening to are rejection letters that have been written to people who we now consider pioneers in their respective fields. Now just imagine the mortification Alfred H. Barr, director of museum collections at the Museum of Modern Art, must have felt when he recalled declining the gift of a drawing from one Andy Warhol.
Dear Mr. Warhol, last week, our committee on the museum collections held its first meeting of the fall season and had a chance to study your drawing entitled Shoe, which you so generously offered as a gift to the museum. I regret that I must report to you that the committee decided, after careful consideration, that they ought not to accept it for our collection. Sincerely, Alfred H. Barr, Jr., Director of Museum Collections. P.S. The drawing may be picked up from the museum at your convenience.
Ain't got nothing at all.
Sometimes being dismissed has nothing to do with the actual talent of the person applying. This apparent form letter from Disney Studios was written back in 1938 to an aspiring artist who was rejected on the basis of her sex.
Dear Miss Ford, your letter of recent date has been received in the inking and painting department for reply. Women do not do any of the creative work in connection with preparing the cartoons for the screen, as that work is performed entirely by young men. The only work open to women consists of tracing the characters on clear celluloid sheets with India ink and filling in the tracings on the reverse side with paint, according to the directions. It would not be advisable to come to Hollywood with the above specifically in view, as there are really very few openings in comparison with the number of girls who apply. Yours, very truly, Mary Cleave, Walt Disney Productions Limited.
Just want to show you what I thought of you.
Here. Oh, that's what you think of me. What's that rash? Think you're smart, don't you? Here.
Oh, baby.
And that was Word of Mouth's small selection of dramatic readings of real rejection letters. You can find even more letters, including one from an editor who passed on the Diary of Anne Frank, calling it, quote, dull. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just spoke with an editor who makes a genuine effort to be kind to people when rejecting their submissions. No matter how you slice it, being rejected is tough, even for the most talented and famous. David Garrelock of the PBS digital series Blank on Blank brings us this story of a musical icon grappling with rejection.
I'm David Garrelock, and this is Blank on Blank, distributed by the Public Radio Exchange. On September 30th, 1970, the journalist Howard Smith called up Janis Joplin for an interview. She was in California, and it would be the last interview that she ever did. Just 4 days later, Janis Joplin died from a heroin overdose. Here's the tape.
We were supposed to do an interview, do you remember? You know, a long time ago. And some article putting you down in Rolling Stone had just come out.
Yeah.
You got very upset about that. Are you still that upset when, you know, you are put down in any articles?
You know, I should be able to get past that, you know, but, I mean, girls want to be reassured, which is not to say that all people don't, but I think women especially. I mean, even though I know that those are just those that don't know what they're talking about, and that I should just continue with my music, you know, and let them either come into the show and listen or go home and beat off. I don't care what they do, you know, I should be able to do that. But in my inside, it really hurts that somebody doesn't like me. You know, it's silly.
This interview originally aired on Howard Smith's radio show, but then it was stashed away for more than 40 years. Now, the Smith Tapes Project has brought it back to life.
Yeah, because I remember that time you were very upset.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty heavy time.
Mm.
For me, it was really important, you know, whether people were going to accept me or not, you know.
A lot of women have been saying that the whole field of rock music is nothing more than just a big male chauvinist ripoff.
Yeah.
And when I say, yeah, well, what about Janis Joplin? She made it. And they say, oh, her. And it seems to bother a lot of women's lib people that you're kind of so upfront sexually.
Maybe that's their problem. Not mine. I haven't ever tried to talk to anybody in women's lib. I haven't been attacked by anyone yet. You know, how can they attack me? I'm representing everything they say they want. You know what I mean? Well, I have an opinion about this, you know, which is sort of like you are what you settle for. Do you know what I mean? You are only as much as you settle for. If they settle for being somebody's dishwasher, that's their own problem. If you don't settle for that and you keep fighting, then, you know, you'll end up anything you want to be. How can they attack me? I'm just doing what I wanted to and what feels right and not settling for bullshit and it worked. How can they be mad at that?
So you better dig it now, right now.
One girl I know said, well, how come she doesn't have any women in any of her groups?
You show me a good drummer and I'll hire one. Show me a good chick. Besides, I don't want a chick in the row with me.
You don't.
I got enough competition, man. No, you know, I like to be around men. Did all that I said about chicks sound bad?
No, you said what you wanted to say. Don't be silly.
Well, I don't want to offend people. It's just that, like, you know, I have, like, a certain set of circumstances that I live under. Like, you know, all this repressive upbringing and things?
Yeah.
I have it, too. I mean, you don't think I had a repressive upbringing, poor protection. It's just that it drove me crazy, and I kept fighting against it. I don't think you can talk anybody into fighting against it if they don't have it in themselves to need more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just plain need more. Then that's that.
If they do need more, they'll get more. They'll demand more. Don't you know what I mean? Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Janelle.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye. You're gonna rise up
singing. Janis Joplin died on October 4th, 1970. I'm David Gerlach. Keep listening.
And that piece came to us from the PBS digital series Blank on Blank. You'll find a link to the interview along with more archived interviews from the series. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. From an assembly of actors to replace Heath Ledger, to plans for a CGI recreation of Philip Seymour Hoffman for the upcoming installment of The Hunger Games, we're going to tackle fake shimps after the news. Word of mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The early death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman left behind a family, a fan base, and an archive of incredible performances. Hoffman also left behind a few unfinished films, among them the final installments of the hugely successful Hunger Games franchise.
Katniss Everdeen is a symbol. We don't have to destroy her, just her image. Show them that she's one of us now. Let them rally behind that.
Lionsgate, the studio behind The Hunger Games, has announced a plan to recreate Hoffman using CGI in order to fill his as-of-yet-unshot scenes. It is a practice that, though somewhat controversial, has been around for a long time. Clay Wirestone is arts editor for the Concord Monitor and a regular contributor to Mental Floss, where he wrote about a number of cases when film studios were forced to use substitute actors, or as they're called in the industry, fake shimps?
That's right. the name dates back to the 1950s when one of the three stooges, Shimp Howard, died unexpectedly in 1955. He just had a heart attack. And the group was still owed Columbia Pictures 4 short subjects. And, they kind of got together, scratched their heads a little bit, and decided to forge ahead by using scenes that had already been shot, some scenes from other shorts, which they were already reusing sometimes. And then they shot a few new scenes with Shimp's stand-in. And he just would have his back to the camera, and he wouldn't say anything. And sometimes the other stooges would say, well, why aren't you saying anything? But anything to kind of make the shorts come together and make them make sense. And then what happened was a couple of decades later, the director Sam Raimi, who a lot of people know for directing all the Spider-Man movies with Tobey Maguire, he and his friends, started making a joke of these shorts because they were big Three Stooges fans. And they started, calling. It's like, oh, there's the fake shimp. There's the fake shimp. They'd recognize where he was. And so when they were making their own low-budget movies, when you didn't have cast available all the time, some people's shots were done, but you needed to have like a dismembered arm or a leg or somebody covered in gore, they would just enlist their friends to come in, put on a wig, have their face away from the camera. And so he would credit them in the credits of his films as fake shimp.
Any other reasons aside from the passing of an actor or an actress why a studio might use a fake shimp?
Oh, yeah. A lot of times you have scheduling is very difficult in Hollywood. I mean, the most recent example of this is in the most recent Thor movie, where Natalie Portman actually had another film that she was doing. And so Chris Hemsworth, who was starring as Thor, he just brought in his wife to be Natalie Portman's lips in a climatic kissing scene, So, it wasn't entirely bad.
How about for injury or, other kind of contractual disputes?
Right. Well, there's a couple of great examples of that. I mean, one of them is, the second Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Harrison Ford had hurt his back really badly, almost actually before the shoot began. And he soldiered on, but at a certain point, he was basically in traction for a couple of weeks. And so his stunt double jumped in. And, usually think of stunt double as just being, he'll do the stunts that the star can't do. But Steven Spielberg decided he was just going to have the stunt double basically do everything that Harrison Ford would do. And it actually worked out remarkably well because the stunt double, at least at the time, looked so much like Harrison Ford that Steven Spielberg actually confused them on the set. The guy's named Vic Armstrong, and there's some pictures of them from the time, and it's really uncanny.
I see in your article here, according to Ford, we could go home to the wrong wives and they wouldn't notice.
Yes. I've seen some more recent pictures of Vic Armstrong, and I don't think it necessarily holds true now, but maybe at the time.
How about contractual disputes that we hear so much about in Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, Superman 2, which is actually a pretty beloved entry in that franchise starring Christopher Reeve, basically the entire movie was shot with one director, Richard Donner, who directed the original Superman movie. And then at a certain point, the studio decided to go in a different direction, brought in a British comedy director named Richard Lester to do it, and who reshot a lot of the movie. But Gene Hackman, who famously played, at least in those movies, Lex Luthor, really didn't like Lester, didn't want to be any part of this new reshooting of it, and so just refused to have anything to do with the reshoots there. He was then replaced by a body double and some voiceover dubs. The other great example of this is, and most people don't even know this, is in the second and third Back to the Future movies, when Crispin Glover wouldn't return because he felt like he wasn't being offered enough money to play George McFly, Marty McFly's dad. They cast another actor, put facial prosthetics on him, sometimes hung him upside down, put dark glasses on him, anything to convince people that it was actually Crispin Glover. And old footage of Crispin Glover, too, from the first movie. And that actually ended up being so controversial that that Glover, you know, sued them and brought an action against them for misappropriating his likeness in those movies. And he actually won. There are actually now rules that prohibit that from happening.
Well, those are sort of old school solutions with the prosthetics and the throwing the voice. How about when did digital solutions rather than the look and sound of light actors become an option for creating shimps?
Yeah, I think the first widely reported one was when Brandon Lee died pretty tragically during the filming of The Crow in 93 or so. He'd filmed most of the movie, but they digitally superimposed his face over a stuntman for a few key shots of that movie. And in the article, at least, I use the term kind of digital shimp. That's kind of the first time you started to see those, but certainly not the last.
Let's hear a clip from the trailer of that film, The Crow, starring Brandon Lee, son of Bruce Lee.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, just sometimes, a crow could bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
And later we read that Ridley Scott used the same techniques to recreate Oliver Reed in his film The Gladiator.
Yes, by the time that Ridley Scott was directing Gladiator, which was in 2000, the technology had advanced enough that they threw a lot of money at it. I think they said some $3 million to digitally recreate Oliver Reed's face, and it looks pretty good. There were not a lot of complaints about that, as opposed to when they tried something like that in The Sopranos a few years before, and it looked really kind of fake and bad.
Oh, when his mother died, Marchand.
Nancy Marchand died of cancer. They had no plan in place. Even though they knew that she was dying of cancer, they're like, well, we're just going to go along with this. And she died unexpectedly, and series creator David Chase just had to cobble something together and make it work.
True to mental floss form, Clay, you number 11 fake shimps. Now, we can't go to 11 today, but any other recent cases of studios using shimps that we might be familiar with?
Well, I mean, kind of more recently and tragically, when Heath Ledger died of a drug overdose in 2008, he was right in the middle of filming a movie called The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, being directed by Terry Gilliam, former Monty Python member. And it was actually a really problematic thing because Heath Ledger's name bankrolled movies, and there was a big danger that the entire movie would fall through and not be able to finish. He hadn't filmed a substantial number of his scenes. So Terry Gilliam put his head together with his daughter, who was a producer on the movie, and they decided, you know, this was already a movie that was about kind of alternate realities, people changing identities, and so they brought in Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell, who all played like other incarnations of the character, as he kind of morphed from one thing to the other.
To varying degrees of success, if I remember.
I don't think it was a resounding success, the movie. But
well, the massive, largely adolescent fan base for The Hunger Games may not have a lot of overlap with devotees to the work of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but they are vocal. Any complaints from them so far about plans to CGI Philip Seymour Hoffman for the final two installments?
You know, I think the word was that he had filmed the vast majority of his appearances. I think there was talk that there's maybe one or so crucial scenes left. So I think everyone, including people who like Philip Seymour Hoffman and people who like The Hunger Games, are just kind of waiting to see and giving it a shot.
Clay Wirestone is himself, no shimping around, arts editor at the Concord Monitor and a regular contributor to Mental Floss. And you'll find a link to read his article, 11 Times When Fake Shimps Replaced Real Actors. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Clay, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
You may remember earlier this month when our producer, Taylor Quimby, had some trouble writing a love song composed of romantic cliches for Valentine's Day. So we turned to you for help completing the song. Well, you responded in a big way, and we're going to be playing some of the best submissions. Signed, sealed, and delivered, we are yours. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Taylor Quimby tried to pen a satirical love song for Valentine's Day, it didn't go so well.
Two lovers in love.
Maybe we need a new lead singer.
Sorry. Sorry, Taylor.
You're out of the band.
So we threw the challenge to you and asked if you could help us perfect Taylor's love song. We crowdsourced the lyrics and gave you the chords, and boy, did you deliver. From crooners to comedians, we got a wide array of submissions. Here's a short compilation of some favorites.
Then I looked into your eyes, still looking at my eyes, still looking at my eyes, still looking at my eyes. And this time I didn't look away. I knew just what to say, and I went like this, 2, 3, 4.
Set me free, be with me, be by my side. All we've been through, wrap my arms, hold me close.
Moments like this, my heart beats for all time. When you walked into the room, when my dreams come true,
when we first met, first kiss, first touch like this, baby.
Part of the song where I suddenly stop before the beat drops. That dirty beat drops. That dirty beat drops. That dirty beat drops. Making lovely love, like lovely lovers do.
Two lovers in love, making lovely love, like lovers do.
True love, pure love, do I say anything for you, love?
Baby, baby, nothing compares to.
And our thanks to John and Sadie Shore, Coco Harris, Noah Watson, NHBR's Ross Boyd, and Word of Mouth's own Zach Nugent for the submissions. Word of Mouth really appreciates the thought and effort you put into your songs. And trust me, we feel the love. You can listen to all of our submissions on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
We both.
We're listening to You Go Down Smooth. It's a new song from the band Lake Street Dive.
You go down smooth.
It's been a crazy couple of months for the band, who played here at NHPR Studio D a little over a year ago. They had their network TV debut on David Letterman last week and the Colbert Report the week before. And they were handpicked by T-Bone Burnett to play the Another Day, Another Time concert, celebrating the music of the Coen brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis. That concert aired on Showtime in December. Despite all the appearances and the heavy touring schedule, Lake Street Dive found time to release their much-buzzed-about fourth full-length album, Bad Self-Portraits, last week. I spoke with the quartet of Rachel Price, Bridget Kearney, Mike Calabresi, and Mike McDuck Olson when they were in the middle of recording Bad Self-Portraits at a studio in rural Maine. I asked them if it was challenging to be confined altogether in a studio when they'd really made their name playing gigs on the road.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot less ease in the studio, I think, in general, just because you're working really hard at this song that you've played a ton, but you're trying to get it as perfect as possible.
Perfect as possible, but also to continue to sound fresh and spontaneous. Mm-hmm. You want to play it on the thousandth time the same way that you played it the first time.
Well, you certainly have been able to bring new energy to some old classics. You were kind enough to play live for us here in NHPR Studio D, so let's hear a little bit from that. This is Lake Street Dive covering the Jackson 5's I Want You Back.
When I had you to myself, I didn't want you around. Those pretty faces always made you stand out in the crowd. But someone picked you from the bunch. One glance was all it took. Now it's much too late for me to take a second look.
Bridget Kearney there on the bass. I think there's a lot of attention on the bass there. Great solo. But really, at the center of this band is definitely Rachel and your voice. How does that sit with you? I mean, you're kind of the focal point for the band.
It sits great with me. I'm super stoked about it. The main reason I'm super stoked about it is that I get to sing the songs that everyone in this band writes. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most exciting part, because everyone, I think, writes really amazing songs, and like, I grew up singing jazz, so the idea of finding songs and putting my own interpretation on them is something that I've always enjoyed doing, and it's exciting to be able to do it with brand new songs.
Although you've done an EP of covers.
We've done an EP of covers, yeah.
And I'm just wondering about that transition from doing covers to writing your own songs when, you know, you have this sound and this experience of doing covers.
To clarify, the covers album is actually something that we put out after several albums of our own material.
I see.
And now we're in the studio working on another album of all original stuff. Songs from all four of us have songs that are going to be on the new album, so that's super exciting.
So you usually individually write a song rather than collaborate on putting a song together?
Yes. We co-wrote a song on the album Lake Street Dive.
Which one?
In the Car.
Is that
what it's called?
It or We Love All the Same Songs?
Songs, you're right. Driving along together in the car, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But after that experience, we decided not to co-write much.
Well, I suppose there's only so much time that you can spend together, you know, the four of you in a car, having that kind of life. You know, I imagine you're just going from place to place a lot.
We are.
All the time.
Uh-huh.
But you still seem to like each other. You're just acting nice for this reason.
Oh, no, we love each other.
Yeah. We get along famously. It's sort of silly. I think that a lot of bands, after the amount of touring we do, they start to wear thin on each other and, you know, little things. You start to resent how the other person breathes, stuff like that. But so far that hasn't happened with us. Shoes? Well,
yeah, actually, I'm remembering a while back we were playing at the Club Passim Campfire Festival, mm-hmm. and the band The Low Anthem was yes. playing before us, which is funny because they're huge now. But anyways, one of the band members came up to me after the show and said, "Are you guys a new band?" And I was like, "No, you know, we've been playing for 3 or 4 years." And he said, "You just have this like energy that you seem like you're enjoying this like freshness about playing with each other."
That's Bridget Carney. She is a bass player and she also sings with the band Lake Street Dive. And let's hear actually one of those originals that you mentioned. This is Bridget's composition. It's called Bad Self-Portraits. This is from the yet-to-be-named album that they're recording right now. This is Lake Street Dive, Bad Self-Portraits. Well, there is nothing quite as lonesome as imagining having a camera that you're about. You want to take pictures of you and your lover, and you end up taking bad self-portraits.
It is really sad. Yeah, that's why we play it so fast. Yeah.
You were all at the New England Conservatory, is that right?
Yep.
I'm just wondering, you know, all of the students there, everyone you could have played with, what is it that brought you four in particular together?
It was McDuck.
Michael Wilson, yeah.
McDuck. What did you see? What did you hear in these people that you wanted to?
Yeah, Mike.
Create?
What did you hear?
Dying to know.
You know, I really wish I had a really concise, like witty, amazing answer for this.
Can you make one up?
I could certainly try. No, it was just a matter of, you know, like, you know, Mike was a buddy of mine from the dorms. You know, I had like a class with Bridget.
A class.
Yeah, it's when you just sing ad.
I meant to say a class. I had seen Rachel at just one of the many sort of multitudinous student concerts that were going on sort of daily. And I thought it was just going to be fun. And it's been fun. And I love you guys.
Oh, should we take a little moment? Sure.
Yeah, we're actually all holding hands. I wish you could see this.
Yeah, yeah. You have to do this all the time.
There is some mythology to it, although that was in a way kind of the original impetus. I would say that everybody at music school has these sort of grandiose ideas, you know, oh, I'm going to write for 8 soprano saxophones and, you know, a chorus of seals or something, you know, and, you know, it's a very cerebral place is music school. And I think that in the end, no one writes for a chorus of seals. No one is a free country band. Thank God.
My conversation with Lake Street Dive from back in October of 2012. For more information on the band's new album, Bad Self-Portraits, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org.
And how long has it been since I've given in to what I see, what is right in front of me?
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, you can send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, we find the most fascinating stories traveling by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
'Cause you use me up and you wear me down. When I'm ahead, I give up.